The top women and men figure skaters are lacing up for the World Championships. They begin tomorrow in Moscow, and the host city is as newsworthy as the skaters. The contests were to be held a month ago in Tokyo, but the massive earthquake in Japan forced the International Skating Union to scramble for a substitute venue. Sports columnist Christine Brennan of USA Today is in the studio. Good morning. Nice to see you again.
Great to see you, Leanne.
So what does the tragedy in Japan, the uncertainty over whether the Worlds would be canceled, the month-long delay, mean for the competitors?
It's really been disruptive. And for several weeks, they didn't know if they'd even have a World Championships. But I think in this time, Leanne, of such self-centered athletes and the behavior so awful in professional sports, these figure skaters around the world distinguished themselves for the comments they made. They said, yeah, it's disruptive of my training, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I've got to start all over again for these 5 weeks. But it's so minuscule compared to what's happening in Japan. And I think they are a shining example of sportsmanship and worthy of our attention because of how wonderful and magnanimous they were towards the people of Japan compared to their plight of having their practice disrupted.
Let's talk about the sports angle, specifically the return to competition of the 2010 Olympic gold medalist Yuna Kim of South Korea. What's she been doing? What are her chances at the Worlds?
It's a great question, Leanne, because what she's been doing, she's been on red carpets and she's been doing benefits and shows and photo shoots and commercials galore. She's a multimillionaire in South Korea. Of course, won the Olympics last year, the great prize, the women's gold medal in figure skating, and went back to South Korea and cashed in, as certainly she should have. But here she comes back. It's so rare to see someone take an entire year off and then come back at the biggest event of the year, the World Championships, and think you can win it. But if anyone can do that, Yuna Kim can in this year of all years.
And who are her rivals, her top rivals?
A couple Japanese skaters who are going to be, of course, sentimental favorites. Mao Asada, who is trying to win her second world title in a row, and if she does that, first time since Michelle Kwan in women's figure skating in the early part of the century, and Miki Ando. So those two, I think, are the ones to watch. Asada won the silver medal at the Olympics behind Yuna Kim, and I think would love to beat her again at the World Championships.
American skater Evan Lysacek, the reigning Olympic gold medalist, will not compete in the men's event. He's doing red carpet. He's turned pro. He appears in ice shows at benefits. So who among the men is worth watching?
I think it's going to be a battle between Canada's Patrick Chan and another Japanese skater, Daisuke Takahashi. Now, Takahashi is 25 years old and is the reigning world champion. And again, coming from Japan with all that emotion, feeling, you know, not now skating in his home country, but skating in the event that should have been in his home country, the Olympic bronze medalist from last year. And then Patrick Chan is 5 years younger than Takahashi. He is the two-time defending world silver medalist and went into the Olympics in Vancouver, in Canada's home country, and did not perform well. And I think he would love to finally get a world title. He's building to the 2014 Olympics. This could be the moment where he really breaks out.
USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan, thanks so much for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Leanne. Thank you.
Low-wage jobs were often filled by young people, but when the recession hit, many of them were squeezed out by adults seeking any work they could get. As the economy improves, there's hope that some entry-level jobs filled by overqualified adults will open up to teens. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates examines the prospects for this summer's job market.
This used to be a common summer job experience when you were somewhere between 16 and, say, 20.
All right, that's going to be 4 to 5 at the next window. Thank you.
Between July and September, you worked at a fast food joint or maybe bagged groceries somewhere. But if lately you've been thinking that your bag boy looks a little long in the tooth, it's probably because he is. Kalima Bluford is an employment officer for the Los Angeles Urban League, and she says the disappearance of entry-level jobs teens used to take for granted has become a nasty reality as adults claim them.
As a result of the economic downturn, we had higher-level individuals that found themselves unemployed. And so what it was literally a domino effect because they began to settle for lower-wage jobs, which pushed everybody else down a notch.
And which often left teens, especially those in ethnic communities, with no notch at all. So when McDonald's held a national hiring day this past Tuesday to fill 50,000 jobs, it resulted in a deluge of would-be employees ready to put on aprons and ask if you want to be supersized. And it's not just burger palaces. Lowe's and Home Depot are hiring thousands of people, mostly for seasonal or temporary work. And banks, once shunned by everyone but business majors as too boring to consider, suddenly have become very attractive.
I don't know that it's the worst year ever, but certainly anecdotally, we have a lot of applicants on the campuses, and when we post jobs on wellsfargo.com, there are times where we can get hundreds of applicants for an individual job.
Pat Callahan is Chief Administrative Officer at Wells Fargo, one of the country's biggest banks. Her company is hiring 1,000 young people around the country to work in various capacities this summer. They're happy to help the U.S. Labor Department's goal of getting the private sector to make 100,000 hires, but Callahan says this isn't a new initiative for her bank.
I actually had my first job in a bank summer intern program in 1976. It wasn't Wells Fargo, but banks have traditionally had summer intern programs, and Wells Fargo is certainly among them and has been hiring summer people for quite a long time.
So the private sector seems not to be the problem.
The big issue is that government, which often sponsors teen programs that provide many people with their first jobs, just does not have the funds available, and a lot of those programs are being cut.
John Challenger is the CEO of Challenger Gray and Christmas. The Chicago-based corporation is the largest outplacement specialist in the country. Challenger says more jobs opening up at the entry level might actually be filled by teens as older people leave for more lucrative employment elsewhere. And while working the fry basket or filling popcorn buckets at the movies might not be lifetime employment, John Challenger says for teens, jobs like those are essential introductions to the working world.
They teach people about reliability, about being on time, give them good customer service skills. So it's a good sign that we're starting to see, instead of big mega layoff announcements, like we always talked about a couple of years ago, these big hiring announcements.
And he's betting that because of the recovering economy, some of those people who are going to be hired are young people who will have a crack at their first real job. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. Much of the world will be in front of the television to see Kate Middleton wed Prince William. Essayist Diane Roberts will be among them. She's had practice watching royals.
I come from a land of princesses. Oh, not the kind you'll see walking into Westminster Abbey on Friday, the kind with five or six names, the kind descended from Charlemagne or William the Conqueror. The princesses I'm talking about rule over peanuts or watermelons or pine trees. They are queens of the cotton festival or the peach parade. In the South, we grow princesses. Girls learn early how to walk in high heels and Vaseline their teeth. There are whole shops dedicated to sequined pageant dresses, ruffled hoop skirts, and long white gloves. Maybe that's why I consider myself a connoisseur of princesses. I cut school to watch Princess Anne's wedding in 1973. She wore a sunburst diamond tiara, the same one her mother wore to marry Prince Philip. When Lady Diana Spencer married the Prince of Wales, I was at university in England. Everybody drank a lot of cheap champagne and pretended to be ironic about the whole thing. For a bunch of people who divorced themselves from kings 200 years ago, we Americans sure are into royalty. Queen Elizabeth II has been the cover girl for Life or Newsweek over a dozen times. Her sister, the sapphire-eyed Princess Margaret, appeared often in Time or Vogue, wearing some fantastic tulle dress or drinking a martini on a beach in the Grenadines. Then there's Princess Diana. She's been dead nearly 14 years, and she still sells magazines. Now Diana's boy is getting married to a nice middle-class girl with long legs and a pretty smile. Like all weddings, this is a family occasion. It's just that 2 billion other people will also be watching it on TV. Maybe it's the mystique royals have managed to hang on to through divorces, sex scandals, inappropriate outfits, and the strong suspicion that they are wildly out of touch with the 21st century. Maybe there's some fairy tale gene buried deep in our psyches. I think it's the tiaras. There's something both completely absurd and completely gorgeous about wearing a big old mess of diamonds, rubies, and emeralds on your head. Miss America looks good in a tiara. Your 7-year-old niece looks good in a tiara. Kate Middleton will look good in a tiara as she walks down the aisle of the Abbey, preparing for a lifetime as a beautiful anachronism.
Diane Roberts practices her court curtsy in Tallahassee, Florida.
George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, these are names we revere as the founding fathers of our nation, planters of the seeds of liberty. But according to a new book, all these great men were also planting food and flowers, collecting trees and shrubs for their own gardens, a pastime that author Andrea Wolfe argues shaped not only the grounds of Monticello and Mount Vernon, but also the new nation. Wolfe has written a book called Founding Gardeners about the revolutionary generation. We met for a talk at the United States Botanic Garden, greenhouses, just south of the Capitol building. This garden, this glass garden under glass that we're sitting in now, was not established or even really seriously underway until 1850, long after the Founding Fathers were gone. But you write in your book that it was the brainchild of George Washington. He thought it was important to have a botanic garden. Now, why?
Well, he, in 1796, when he's thinking about his retirement, one of the things he wants to leave as a legacy is a national university, which would bring all young men from the 13 different states together. And in the same way, he was thinking about a botanic garden, that if it would be a garden that would unite the America's flora from all 13 states, that it would be a reminder of America, and it would also provide a almost like a nursing ground from where to send these trees to other places in the nation. So he was talking about the parent trees that should be sent out to other states in America.
So the parent trees would grow in the botanic garden and seeds and seedlings would then travel out to the states?
Would be sent out to other nurseries and seed collectors, because they really all believed that America's trees were a reflection of the nation, of this kind of strong, young, fertile nation. So Washington, for example, creates a all-American garden in Mount Vernon, and I would argue it's the first American garden in the Young Republic, which he starts actually on the eve of the Battle of New York, when the British are about to attack New York. 30,000 British troops are, you know, about to arrive in New York. He brushes aside his generals and his military maps, and he sits down and writes a letter to his estate manager in Mount Vernon, asking him to design a new garden. And what is more remarkable than the timing, really, is that he's asking for only native species.
Only American plants.
Yes, only American plants. It's almost like as if he wants to create an all-American garden where no English tree is allowed to claw its roots in the soil.
George Washington, in his... it was not the, according to your book, not the only innovation that George Washington created, the American garden. But he also pioneered a sort of use of manure in gardens.
Well, I have to say, I think one of the biggest surprises I had when I wrote this book is to discover that the first four presidents of the United States were all utterly obsessed with manure. So Washington, for example, is the first American to collect farm dung in a specially designed building. They are looking at the depleted soil, really, from tobacco cultivation. And in order to replenish the soil, they are all experimenting with manure, or what we would call compost probably today. So they're exchanging recipes. And there's a wonderful image, I think, of John Adams as the American minister in London, who literally jumps into a pile of manure, teasing apart the straw from the dung, and then gleefully declaring that is not equal to mine. So they're all totally obsessed with manure.
You know, I think of John Adams as the, you know, sort of a, you know, sort of feisty president. And you think of his wife, Abigail Adams, and their relationship. But I did not know until I read your book that he was a mad gardener.
Yeah, I mean, I think of all of them, Adams, I think, is what we would most recognize today as a gardener, because he loves his dirt. I mean, he just loves getting his hands dirty and having his hands in the, you know, in the manure, in the soil. And he, whenever he is involved in political battles, he is yearning yearning to be in his garden. He says, like, you know, the thing I would love to do most now is be digging in my potato yard. And I think Abigail quite enjoys him, you know, going to the garden and working off his temper. Mm. So he has this totally visceral connection with the soil, I think.
Jefferson was a great believer in expanding westward and collecting more land and more land and more land. But you write that James Madison was much more interested in caring for and preserving land.
James Madison is, you know, known as the father of the Constitution here, but he is really also the father of American environmentalism. He gives a speech in 1818, which is just extraordinary, which was very wildly circulated also in Europe, in which he condemns the Virginians for their ruthless exploitation of the soil and destruction of the forest. And he says that in order for America to survive, Americans have to protect their environment. And he's talking about nature as a very fragile ecological system, and that man had to find a place within nature without destroying it.
Andrea Wolfe. Her new book is Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature, and the Shaping of the American Nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Panda Express sells sweet, sticky Chinese fast food in malls all over the country, but now they're looking towards a bigger market. It's been reported that the company is thinking of opening stores in China. But will their Americanized menu fly in Beijing? Is the Chinese food we know and love anything an actual Chinese person would recognize?
The Chinese food that we eat in America is very alien to Chinese people.
That's journalist Jenny Ait Lee. She's tracked the origins of a classic American Chinese dish, deep-fried, sauce-drenched General Tso's chicken.
I actually went to the hometown of General Tso, which is in the Hunan province, and there are 300 members of his family still hanging out in this little town. And I showed them pictures of General Tso's chicken, and I said, do you know this dish? And they looked at it, and they're like, huh, we've never seen this. And then they would squint and say, is this Chinese food? Because it doesn't look like Chinese food to them.
And it really isn't Chinese food, Lee says.
American Chinese food actually is its own cuisine. There is actually a chain of restaurants in South Korea that sells American Chinese food called Ho Lee Chow. And they have on that menu beef with broccoli and General Tso's chicken.
But how did egg rolls and chop suey get to be the all-American comfort foods they are today? Luckily for us, the National Museum of American History has just unveiled a little exhibit on the history of the Chinese restaurant in this country. It's called Sweet and Sour. And curator Cedric Yeh gave me a quick tour through 150 years of Chinese food in America.
These plates are from Chinese restaurants in Hawaii. But really why they're here is to demonstrate the chop suey emblem that you see on this. Because chop suey appeared around this time, early 1900s, even early late 1800s. And it took off like wildfire and spread across the country. And it helped really make the Chinese food experience something exotic and adventuresome for the people in America to sample and try. I mean, it became the thing that everybody wanted to have.
Is it true that chop suey never existed in China?
Well, you know, that's the interesting story. I had wanted to say that it was an American invention. That's been a story that's been going on since I was a child. Recent research has shown that dishes like chop suey existed in China. I think the story that I like to tell, anyways, is that I asked my parents. They ran a Chinese restaurant themselves, and they've been my best source or my source of information for a lot of my questions. And I asked them about chop suey, because it wasn't on our menu, but I asked them. And what my father said was, well, chop suey can be loosely translated into extra bits, miscellaneous parts, or leftovers. And he said, who doesn't have leftovers? You know, you'll be able to find these materials.
So chop suey, though, started Americans being interested in Chinese food, kinds of restaurants.
Yeah, those kind of restaurants. Now, they were already eating at the Chinese restaurants beforehand, but this really started something. It helped start a craze, if you will, a fad that lasted quite some time. But it really allowed the Chinese to move, to open up new restaurants, to carry that fad with them. And because people knew about it, you know, to succeed where they opened those restaurants, to kind of move across the country.
Now, I want to know those strange-looking tongs.
Right.
What are those?
The other thing that happened around that same time as the chop suey craze was starting is the introduction of the fortune cookie, the Chinese restaurant fortune cookie that we all know today. Now, this one, I like to say, is an American invention. And the tongs were from San Francisco, and they were used to help make the first fortune cookies. And they were called tea cakes.
So were they cooked by the cast iron tongs?
Yeah, they would be heated up. It's an important part of the story, and you know that it started, you know, so early, and it's become such a large part of the Chinese restaurant experience, and to be identified with Chinese food.
Do you have any idea why it happened?
No, that's still something we're looking into.
Somehow, though, Chinese food has really captured this country.
I would venture to say, this is another personal saying, that it's the new comfort food. It's probably as American as anything else we have on our menus and our daily eating habits. Even if you don't like Chinese food, you pretty much name what's going to be on the menu. We're all familiar with it, and it's become a part of our eating habits.
But what if you're wandering around Chinatown with an appetite for something truly authentic? Jenny Ait Lee has this tip.
No American, fully American Chinese restaurant would serve jellyfish.
No jellyfish.
No jellyfish.
It's not truly Chinese.
Yeah.
Well, you know what they do here in Washington, I guess you do know because I'm sure you've seen this, is that the Chinese menu is in Chinese, posted on little flags around the walls.
Exactly. It is a secret code. It is meant to keep you guys out, actually. And you know, and this is, but I'll tell you what you can do. You can do, this is an interesting trick. You just point to very expensive things and take your gamble, the fact that they're expensive, that they're going to be good.
Our thanks to Jenny Ait Lee and Cedric Yeh at the National Museum of American History, where you can see the sweet and sour display and use our handy tips to get a good lunch in Chinatown, which is just a few blocks away.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. At the Vatican today, Pope Benedict XVI focused his Easter message on the many conflicts and natural disasters that have caused suffering and destruction throughout the world. The Pope's Easter Mass was the culmination of Holy Week, but the Vatican will still be busy in the coming days preparing for next week's beatification of Pope John Paul II. NPR's Silvia Poggioli is on the line from Rome. Good morning, Silvia.
Good morning, Leanne.
Elaborate on the Pope's message this year.
Well, along with rejoicing on the day that marks the resurrection of Christ, which is the most important date on the Catholic calendar, the Pope also focused on current events. He appealed that in Libya, diplomacy and dialogue take the place of weapons and people be given access to humanitarian aid. He also called for peaceful coexistence among the peoples of the Ivory Coast, that's been rocked by violence for months. And he urged consolation and hope in Japan in the aftermath of the recent earthquake and tsunami. And as a backdrop to the ceremony, St. Peter's Square was really resplendent with magnificent displays of brightly colored spring flowers, peach blossoms, azaleas, and many others.
And the week goes on. The Pope will beatify his predecessor, John Paul II, next week. How is Rome getting ready for that event?
Well, it's expected to be the biggest event since John Paul's funeral 6 years ago. The Vatican is expecting perhaps as many as 1 million pilgrims. Posters with the smiling face of the Polish-born Pope are everywhere on walls and on buses, and there are hundreds of gadgets and souvenirs on sale. Security, of course, will be very high, but the mood is already very festive.
John Paul II was one of the longest-serving popes in history. What message is being sent about his beatification?
Well, you know, he was one of the major figures of the 20th century. He was the first non-Italian pope since the Renaissance, and he was a man of great faith. A pope from the communist East, he's seen as one of the major catalysts of the fall of communism in Europe. Another achievement was taking the seat of Catholicism out of Rome and traveling throughout the world as a spiritual pastor. He also championed ecumenical and interfaith dialogue, and he opened up channels of cooperation with other religions, including Islam. He had a particular feeling for the young, who flocked to his masses as if they were rock concerts, and he made history by formally apologizing for the sins of Catholicism over the centuries.
But Sylvia, aren't there questions being raised over the unprecedented speed of John Paul's beatification process?
Yes, it's said to be the fastest on record, and Pope Benedict suspended the traditional 5-year waiting period. And this is the first time in 1,000 years that a pope has beatified his own predecessor. One leading church historian, Michael Walsh, has pointed out that most of the people involved in the process, including the current pope, owe their jobs in some way to John Paul, and so he says they can't be seen as impartial. The strongest criticism concerns John Paul's handling of clerical sex abuse, the biggest scandal in the Catholic Church in centuries. Many of the cases that have come to light occurred on John Paul's watch, and little or nothing was done to punish abusive priests. Even more controversial was the late pope's benevolent attitude toward the Order of the Legionaries of Christ. The founder, the Mexican priest Marcial Maciel Degollado, was accused of sex abuse by many young men, but he continued to enjoy John Paul's favor. The pope saw the wealthy religious order as a model of orthodoxy. Many Vatican watchers say this was John Paul's greatest failure.
And finally and briefly, Sylvia, if there are these unresolved issues about John Paul II's papacy, why did Benedict speed up the beatification?
Well, you know, with so many Catholics abandoning the church, especially in Europe, the Vatican hopes this beatification will restore luster to the church and bring back the faithful.
NPR Sylvia Pagioli in Rome. Thank you, Sylvia. Happy Easter.
Thank you, Leanne. Happy Easter to you, too.